Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss the personal politics of health. The conventional treatment trajectory for cardiovascular disease is linear and predictable. If you have high blood pressure, angina, blocked arteries, and high cholesterol, you'll receive an angioplasty, several pharmaceuticals, and a low-fat diet. Oddly, doctors never saw cardiovascular and heart disease and heart attacks much before 1928, when highly polyunsaturated and processed fats replaced butter and lard. And the incidence of cardiovascular disease continues to climb. So what do we know about the etiology of strokes, atherosclerosis, and heart disease? I mean, what do we know about why it occurs, not just how to suppress its symptoms? In the next hour, I'll be unpacking some of the newest research about how to protect people from developing cardiovascular disease and how to treat its underlying cause, often nutrient deficiencies. Stay with me. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. The latest issue of the Public Library of Science Medicine is devoted to disease mongering, creating diseases that turn healthy people into patients. The editors and contributors to the issue describe how widespread disease mongering has become, and how it is the result of a complex stew driven by a pharmaceutical industry that enlists indirectly and directly public relations companies, researchers, professional organizations, and patient advocacy groups. Disease mongering not only includes campaigns to create diseases where none existed before, like cardiovascular disease and metabolic syndrome, but the elevation of conditions suffered by a few into epidemics, such as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The articles describe how pharmaceutical companies drive this ship based on the need to maintain sales. In some cases, this includes repurposing drugs from one condition to another. Statins are notorious for this, having research shift from anti-cholesterol to anti-inflammation to anti-cancer. In what was news to me, Prozac has now been repurposed and named Seraphim to treat the hitherto unknown disease premenstrual dysphoric disorder. But disease mongering isn't just about big pharma marketing to consumers, or even about a pharmaceutical company promoting concern for a condition for which they coincidentally have the perfect drug. Researchers get financial support for investigating the seriousness of these conditions. Medical professionals who specialize in the condition have a mixture of professional and financial interest in expanding the attention paid to the condition. Don't forget that only 10% of big pharma marketing is directed at consumers. The other 90% is directed at medical professionals. Finally, there are patient advocacy groups that join in promoting a condition. Take, for example, the American Diabetes Association. The ADA is heavily supported by the pharmaceutical companies that sell anti-diabetes drugs. The supposed diabetes epidemic and the ensuing drive to get people into treatment as early as possible is a direct consequence. Leave aside the negative effects of anti-diabetes drugs, if you look at the statistics for this epidemic, like I have, you discover that it's not everywhere. The increases are principally among African Americans. For me, that tells a different story than more drugs. A recent report intended for pharmaceutical industry leaders discussed lifestyle drugs. The report emphasized that, quote, "The coming years will bear greater witness to the corporate-sponsored creation of disease," close quote. We don't need a conspiracy theory. They're telling us what they're going to do. Which brings me to Medicare Part D. This is the alleged prescription drug benefit created by the Bush administration. It would be more accurate to call it the Medicare part that transfers income from taxpayers to drug companies. The core question for consumers is how much coverage they need. The plan seems to work for those with few drug needs and for those with huge drug needs, but not for those in between. In the age of disease mongering, Medicare recipients contemplating Part D, and the rest of us for that matter, should ask whether we need the drugs at all. For a copy of this editorial, go to our webpage, yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Jeffrey Fawcett, PhD, is a political economist, writer, and health educator who works with individuals. He co-produces this radio show, and he is editor of the Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to big box medicine. You can reach him by going to our website, or you can call him directly at 707-874-1496. A brief announcement before I introduce my topic. The Public Health Education course for Saturday, April 22nd, at the Occidental Center for the Arts has been canceled. Again, the talk, All the Health News That Doesn't Fit, for April 22nd, has been canceled. And now to my topic, cardiovascular disease prevention. Well, let's begin by talking about what's being blamed for its cause. What's currently the popular theories for what's causing cardiovascular disease? Primarily what's been blamed, and what still gets blamed, oddly, even though all the research to support it has been sort of turned upside down. I mean, it's gone close investigation. What you find is, of course, cholesterol has never been shown in even large research projects to be causative for cardiovascular disease. So cholesterol, fat in the diet, and plaquing and inflammation. These are the causes: cholesterol, fat in the diet, plaquing, and inflammation. So let's take them one by one. Cholesterol. I think you know how I feel about this. I just shot off about it. But most of you who listen to the show regularly have heard Dr. Ufi Ravenskov on this show. His name is spelled U-F-F-E. His last name, R-A-V-N-S-K-O-V. He's a PhD, MD. If you have not heard him, his book is called The Cholesterol Myths, and we have a variety of shows on our show list on our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, and you can certainly listen to him. What he's done is go back and look at all of the credible research on cholesterol and heart disease, and over again, what he shows you as he unpacks all the research very, 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 in a very meticulous way, is that it's never been shown in research to be a cause of heart disease. Interestingly, even the drugs that are designed to lower cholesterol tend to be having an effect on heart disease through a different mechanism. Instead of having the cholesterol lowering be effective, what's happening is that they're reducing inflammation. So we talked recently about statin drugs and what kind of bill there is attached to reducing inflammation through the use of a statin drug, which is immunosuppressant and actually causes a lot of side effects. Cholesterol is life-giving. It's a wax. It's not a fat. It carries antioxidants through the body. It increases immunologic response. People with low cholesterol tend to have lower resistance to viruses and flus and parasites and bacteria. It's the building block for all of our sex hormones, including testosterone, which is heart protective in both genders by contesting clotting. In other words, all of your hormones work in conjunction with each other, and they all have different effects. Estrogen in both genders is really important for brain function, and in women it does also protect the heart, but it tends to make the blood a little clottier. But testosterone and progesterone both have the opposite effect. So particularly testosterone is very important in both genders. Cholesterol, and so what I'm saying is low cholesterol, low testosterone. Cholesterol goes up in response to stress and illness. So if you are tested right before you come down with a flu, your cholesterol will be much higher than you would expect it to be. And stress and illness are major risk factors for cardiovascular disease because stress itself tends to cause an effect in the body of restricting blood flow to the heart, since it's constant stress. A stress response, a long-term chronic stress response, is your body is trying to send blood to your legs and your arms so you can run away or fight. So there's less blood going to your gut and your heart. And stress is a major factor because, as I just said, it makes the blood thicker and clottier. Cholesterol is the raw material for many of our cells. Our phospholipids in our brain are made primarily of cholesterol. the surfactant in your lung, the surface of your lung, is cholesterol. If you don't consume enough cholesterol, the body will make it if it gets too low, even if you eat a low-fat diet. So what's causing the plaquing if it's not cholesterol? All right, well, let's talk about clotting and plaque. There are specific genetic mutations that can interfere with vital nutrients, and that interference increases your chances of having blood that's clotty or having other mechanisms that cause a clot to form. What this means is that the vital nutrients are allowing various pathways that take place in a cascade throughout your body to go through their entire pathway and not to be interrupted at some point, or to have the pathway sort of be hijacked and go in a different direction, causing another substance which is irritating instead of causing things to work the way they're supposed to with a certain kind of homeostatic balance. So certain genetic mutations can interfere with these vital nutrients, and you can sort of tell if you have them in your family even without testing, because you will have relatives in your family who have had really early heart incidents. In the extreme, you might have a parent or a grandparent or an uncle who actually died of an early heart attack from 45 to 55 or something like that. Or if you just see a preponderance of people having first heart attacks in their 50s, you would be concerned that there's a genetic mutation involved. But anywhere you see a lot of vascular problems, if you look in your genetic line and you see a lot of strokes, a lot of heart problems of various sorts, hypertension, people having angina and heart pain, people having bypass surgery early, this can give you some sense of what kind of nutrient program you should be on, because the sorts of nutrients that are heart protective will never hurt you if you take a robust amount of them. They're not harmful. They're not going to throw other nutrients out of balance if you take them. So just paying attention to your family history will help you get a sense of this. The genetic mutation or tendency, it's not an actual mutation, but it produces a tendency, is this tendency for people to have high homocysteine. And as you've heard discussed, this was discovered by Kilmer McCulley, I can't recall exactly how to spell his name, but you can find it on our topic list under heart shows with him. But he was the person who discovered that this was a much bigger cause for heart attacks and clotting events in people, and it sort of put the cholesterol myth to bed. And it was considered sort of outrageous at the time that he brought it up, and it was so much so transgressive that he lost his position at Harvard because of it, even though he's a highly respected researcher. He has since been regarded for this work, but the cholesterol myth persists, even though he has discovered this. Now, homocysteine, as I've mentioned before on this show, homocysteine is produced when you metabolize one particular protein, but in fact protein in general. And what happens is that as your body is using these very important sulfur-containing amino acids in protein to cause, to potentiate your detoxification pathways and to in the end come up with something called glutathione, if you have this tendency to produce high homocysteine, or if your behaviors are imprudent, like if you are somebody who goes to eat at one of these steak restaurants where they serve you an entire pound of steak, and you actually consume a pound of meat, even if your homocysteine levels tend to be normal, you'll raise your homocysteine and put yourself at risk. So meat eaters get pounded for this because it is the case that if you overconsume meat, you will cause this kind of clotting event. But most people know better than to eat a pound of meat at a time. This is, it's kind of absurd. So homocysteine is an interruption in the pathway toward glutathione. The body is unable to continue on. It gets stuck at homocysteine, which is one of the steps, and high homocysteine causes clotting events, and I'm going to explain exactly how that happens soon. Other causes that are involved in this issue of clotting and plaque is impaired carbohydrate metabolism and diabetes. So you don't have to be a full-blown diabetic to have this going on. If you are beginning to move in the direction of something that might be called metabolic syndrome, not to create a new disease, but to just give you some kind of context for understanding when you begin to have symptoms like high blood sugars or high triglycerides, which actually are fats in your blood. Cholesterol is not a fat, it's a wax, but the triglycerides in your blood are fats, and they do go up in response to sugary carbohydrate meals. And if your triglycerides are climbing above 100 and your blood sugar is climbing above 100, you may be moving in the direction of having an impaired carbohydrate metabolism and possibly moving in the direction of it being so impaired that you are diabetic. These conditions increase the risk of something called small fractionated LDL cholesterol. So the LDL cholesterol is the one that gets the bad rap, although I would challenge anybody to survive without it. LDL cholesterol carries antioxidants throughout the body. And it becomes a problem if, like I said, in family lines where there is an impaired carbohydrate metabolism and people are not protecting themselves from these high blood sugars, one of the things that can happen is that their LDL cholesterol, instead of being fluffy and small, becomes small and dense. And when the HDL cholesterol comes through to scrub out the LDL, which has laid in the antioxidants, now the HDL comes through to clean it out, some of it's so small that a piece will break off and a clot will form. And that will cause a blood clot or an interruption or a cardiovascular event. Now, when we talk about clots, it's very important to also understand that not all clots are unstable. You can have a clot form and it can sit there and just be there forever and never cause blockage in the arteries. In addition to that, when you hear that somebody's arteries are blocked, an important thing to remember is that arteries can bypass themselves if they're allowed to. So there's a physician named Howard Wayne who likes to use a lot of medications and pharmaceuticals for this, but he is a non-surgical cardiologist. He believes that people's parameters, their cardiovascular parameters, can be controlled without surgery, and that when you do an angioplasty, you run the risk of rupturing an artery and damaging it. And also, when you do a bypass, you cut a lot of nerves, which make it possible for people not to feel their symptoms when they have a blockage. And what he says, and he's quite eminent in his field, is that if you leave the blockage alone, the artery will eventually, the arteries will eventually create their own bypass. So keep in mind that not all clots are unstable and that arteries can bypass themselves when somebody is shaking an angioplasty in your face, ready to drive it up your artery. You can suggest they drive it somewhere else, actually. Lipoprotein A is another very difficult clotting factor. I don't know a lot about lipoprotein A. I know that it's quite serious in the families that it runs in. It does tend to appear in African-American genetic lines. The good news about it is it does respond to high doses, relatively high doses of niacin. And I should caution here that not everybody feels okay taking niacin. Not everybody needs niacin. But if you know that you have lipoprotein A, it behooves you to take some of it. Other things that can increase the chance that somebody will have one of these clotting effects, like homocysteine, small particle LDL, lipoprotein A, is if there is something called, if methylation is not occurring. And methylation is complicated enough so that I'm not going to try to explain it except to say that it has to do with the donation of carbon atoms, which is essential for all your cells to function. And it is dependent on methyl donating substances like betaine, which is trimethylglycine, or folate metabolism. So in other words, there are nutrients that potentiate methylation, and if methylation is insufficient, the clotting factors are more likely to occur, particularly homocysteine. So another mutation that can occur is that people can have a specific mutation that interferes with their ability to utilize folic acid. And people are low enough in folic acid as it is. There have been studies showing that it's terribly important, and they've started putting it in everything, but apparently not enough or the right form for people who have a DNA mutation. A quick ID. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm doing a show today on cardiovascular disease prevention. So these are DNA mutations that can be tested. The most common of them is something called MTHFR, but there are several that sound similar to that. What this one particularly means is that you are missing the enzymes for folic acid and you don't methylate folic acid properly. So in cases like this, people will need to take high doses of folic acid, and some people will need to take methyl-donating substances as well. So there are lots of nutrients that protect from the formation of homocysteine, and homocysteine, again, is important along with these other clotting factors because homocysteine, unlike the other ones, can become high even in healthy people with normal levels, and people can test normal for homocysteine and not be. So it's not that easy to check. The thing to remember about homocysteine is, like I said before, you can potentiate a high homocysteine just by just being really imprudent about the servings of protein that you have. If you are omnivore, if you are a person who eats everything and you do eat meat, the thing to do is to keep your servings of meat below 8 ounces at a sitting, depending on your size. And you're okay if you do that and you have a good nutrient program, you're fine. So small servings of protein throughout the day are not a problem. It's these huge servings at one time of 8 ounces and above. But other things will also increase homocysteine in people, nutrient deficiencies being the primary one. But let's for a moment go back and look at why it is that homocysteine is a problem, because it's very interesting in view of a recent interview I did with Malcolm Kendrick and Ufi Ravenskov about heart disease, what is it really, because Malcolm Kendrick, who is a Brit who lives in England, did an essay about what it is that actually causes myocardial infarctions, where the heart muscle infarcts and there's a heart attack and some of the muscle is apparent, they call it dead. They say it's dead. What is actually going on there? Because what he's found looking at the research is that the heart event occurs and the clotting event actually occurs much later. So it isn't clear what's causing the heart attack or what the heart attack is or why the heart gets scarred and damaged. And I was reviewing some notes by Dr. Richard Cunyon, K-U-N-I-N, and discovered this explanation of how homocysteine works. And I think it gives you an insight into what Malcolm Kendrick had discovered. First of all, plaquing is made up mostly of platelets. It's not cholesterol. It's platelets. And what happens with homocysteine is that homocysteine, when it's high, induces an acute spasm of the vessel. So you get this vasospasm, and that causes the blood pressure to go up and the blood flow to go down. And this is often mistaken as a blockage. It's actually a vasospasm. This vasospasm can last over 4 hours, and that's long enough to cause cell death and organ damage. So this might be what's actually going on. It's not a blockage. It's high homocysteine that's causing a vasospasm. Now, interesting enough, there was a research paper that was done by doctors Chambers and McGregor, and what they discovered was that they could have all of this could be avoided by giving somebody 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C and it would protect them from the event. So 500 milligrams of vitamin C was insufficient. 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C, if they tried to cause this thing to happen, would protect, would keep it from happening. And the thing to remember about vitamin C, gosh, how simple is that, is that it has to be replaced throughout the day. You have to replete vitamin C because we don't make it in our bodies. Vitamin C, when we were wild animals, and some wild animals still can do this, not our domesticated animals, will make vitamin C in their bodies. We will not, neither will our cats or dogs. And we use it up rather quickly. And my favorite study, which I've cited on the air before, is with some firemen who were given 10,000 milligrams of vitamin C and sent out to fight a fire. And when they came back 2 or 3 hours later, they were retested and there was no vitamin C left in their body at all. So under stress, vitamin C is burned up. And this is why people who are ill or have cancer or have a really bad infection will be able to tolerate higher levels of vitamin C without getting diarrhea from it, which is what you get when you take more than you need. Insufficient vitamin C, so 1,000 milligrams repleted throughout the day, is sufficient to protect, just not this alone, to protect someone with high homocysteine levels from having a vasospasm that can be mistaken as a blockage and cause the heart muscle to be scarred. Pretty amazing, vitamin C. Now, ischemia, which is lack of blood to the heart, ischemia from homocysteine causes hypertension. It causes atherosclerosis. It causes arterial aneurysms. So those of you who have stroke in your family line, you have to be very cautious about your homocysteine levels. Again, homocysteine goes up with huge servings of protein, and whether you eat too much protein or not, deficiencies of folic acid, B12, B6, and for some people, not everybody, this undermethylation, which is boosted by methyl donators like betaine or trimethylglycine, which is TMG. Now, this is very plentiful in spinach. It can be purchased as a supplement, but it's also in spinach. So this is fairly easy to fix, if you get what I'm saying. So if you are a person with these tendencies in your line and you make sure that you're getting enough of these vital nutrients, you're getting 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C at least 3 times a day, and you're taking the extra B12 and B6 and folic acid. And B12, incidentally, is a huge thing. It's also possible for all of these nutrients to be blocked by things, too, and interfered with. So it's very important to continue to take them on a daily basis. If you test positive for a folate problem, or if you have a lot of vascular disease in your family, doses of folic acid in the 1 milligram to 5 milligram range 2 times a day with a product that has folic acid and possibly something like folinic acid, F-O-L-I-N-I-C, folinic acid in it. There is a product that's an under-the-tongue product that Intensive Nutrition produces. That's a good product because it is under the tongue and the only one I know of that is under the tongue. But there are also other companies that are making folinic acid. There are companies making products that have tetrahydrofolate in it. These are all useful for people with a genetic mutation. 1 gram, that's 1,000 milligrams, of B12 in the methylcobalamin, not the cyanocobalamin. So methyl, again, like your methyl groups, not the cyano. The cyanocobalamin is the most prevalent form of B12 out there, and it is a very inexpensive form of B12. It's actually, the cyan means that it has, it has a mild poison in it, and it is actually quite toxic for diabetics. So cyanocobalamin is not the right thing to use for most people. You want either a methyl or some other form of cobalamin. And again, 1,000 milligrams 2 times a day before breakfast and before lunch. Between 1 and 200 milligrams of B6 would be good. And it's essential to have good mineral ratios are also essential. I'm going to need to take a brief break, so what I'm going to do is pick up from where I left off on this issue of good mineral ratios after I take a break. This is your own health and fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman. I'm doing a show on cardiovascular risk prevention. I'm going to take 30-second or so break, and I ask you to please stay with me. I'll be right back. Welcome back. This is your own health and fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I'm here doing a show alone on cardiovascular risk protection. If you missed parts of today's show and want to get a copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can go to the website and listen to it all week long at yourownhealthandfitness.org, and is spelled out. You'll also find information on ordering CDs there. And you can find information on the Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to Big Box Medicine, the quarterly, and how to get a copy of this and any other in the series or any of the past shows or whatever there as well. Or you can call 707-874-2772. Jeff Fawcett just reminded me that cyano is cyanide. So, I mean, you know, the dose makes the poison. Not everything is poisonous at that dose, but cyanocobalamin is not a good form of B12 for most people. There are some people who can take it, but it's very inexpensive, and you're better off with a methyl cobalamin. Now, vitamins and minerals, all of these things work in ratio to each other, so it isn't enough to just go running out and sort of get the folic acid, the B12, the B6, and the trimethylglycine, and to think you're finished, because that's not the case. Everything potentiates pathways and works together, so it's important to have, at the very least, a good multivitamin that's robust in your B vitamins. And even if you do take that, if there's a cardiovascular risk in your family line, you still want to take those other nutrients. Trimethylglycine is different for different people. Not everybody needs extra methylation. Some people need B12, B6, and folic acid, and they don't need the trimethylglycine. When they take trimethylglycine, it makes them feel jittery or it makes them feel poorly for some reason. It's very easy to tell if that's the case, and you can stop taking it. But my observation is a lot of women for sure need the folic acid, the B12 and the B6, and some need the extra TMG, and men often need TMG. So you can also probably guess this if there are other things in your family line that have to do with problems with detoxification. So good mineral ratios. Everything, as you have heard over and over again as a principle on this program, is that things work in relationship to each other. So there's a handshake between everything. All of your hormones have a handshake with each other, and they balance each other. All your vitamins do, and all of your minerals do. And the mineral ratios are essential for heart protection. So potassium balances sodium. In other words, when people have hypertension, they're often given something to either block their, you know, there's all kinds of calcium blockers, or there's different things they give very high doses of a drug-like version of potassium or various other things, and they restrict sodium. Essentially, if you're taking a balance of potassium to sodium, if your diet, if you're not eating a whole lot of processed foods and you want to add a little salt to your diet, that may be fine. Not everybody with hypertension has a sodium-sensitive hypertension. Hypertension is primarily often an emotional problem, although it can also be triggered by these other problems like homocysteine and all these clotting factors. So it's a symptom. It isn't a problem by itself. And increasing potassium to balance the sodium in your diet often will regulate that issue. And another issue here is that if somebody is very low, if their cortisol production, if their adrenal function, you know, if somebody says to them, you have adrenal fatigue, which is a big sort of blanket diagnosis for anyone who's tired these days, you need sodium to keep your adrenal cortex working like it's supposed to. So you have to be careful about restricting sodium. You probably don't want to just eat tons of processed foods with sodium, but you also increase your potassium. Your copper to zinc ratio is very, very important. And copper and zinc are both very heart protective. And this copper to zinc ratio is especially delicate in diabetics and people with impaired carbohydrate metabolism. So you don't need tons of copper, 1 to 2 milligrams a day of copper, and zinc maybe 50 milligrams unless you are somebody who always tests low in zinc. Diabetics and people with thyroid disease are often very low in zinc. People with thyroid disease often find that they can't take a lot of copper. Maybe they only take it once a week. You have to experiment. But copper to zinc ratio is a handshake, and they potentiate each other, as does potassium and sodium balance and keep them in check. Calcium to magnesium is very important with this issue of hypertension and heart disease and stroke and all of that, because calcium is a vasoconstrictor, so it constricts the arterial blood flow, and magnesium dilates or opens the blood flow. So that ratio also has to be protected. So in other words, instead of taking a calcium channel blocker, you might just take extra magnesium because it's a natural calcium blocker. The vitamins, vitamin D and vitamin K, control where calcium is deposited. What happens as people age is the parathyroid begins to sense that there isn't enough calcium, especially if there's a deficiency of K and D. They sense there's not enough calcium around, and it starts to pull, even actually just as an aging process, this happens, it starts to pull calcium out of the bones. And the calcium without sufficient D and K tends to get pulled more out of the bones, and it deposits inappropriately throughout the body, particularly often in the aortic valve as people age, and that causes the aortic valve to start to collapse. So vitamin D, people have been hearing more and more about how important vitamin D is, but people don't think about it in terms of the heart, and they don't think about it in terms of calcium and minerals. But it's terribly important because it regulates where the calcium goes and it protects you from having this event where calcium is pulled out of your bones. So vitamin D, if you're not getting 15 minutes of sun during the time of 12 to 2 during the summer, if you're not getting that much sun during the summer on your skin, or if you're out there with sunscreen on, then you will need 3,000 to 4,000 IUs of vitamin D. And the only time I've found that this is a problem is if you have a rather rare autoimmune disease. Most people know if they have a rare autoimmune disease, but there is one rare autoimmune disease that will cause you to hang on to vitamin D, and then you become overdosed on it, which reverses the benefits, of course. A 25-hydroxy-D is a normal test for testing a metabolite of vitamin D. If you have strange autoimmune diseases, you might want a 1,025 test of hydroxy vitamin D test. It's a different test. Vitamin K is oddly now being shown to be needed in much higher doses than anyone ever dreamed, and one of the reasons it's often withheld is because it's thought to increase clotting. What it really does is regulate clotting. It doesn't actually increase it so much as just regulate it and make sure that it occurs properly. It also protects and nurtures the arterial walls and keeps them strong. So it's often withheld where people are being given blood thinners, where the thought is that their blood is, we've been talking about clotting and plaquing and all this stuff, and one of the things that comes up here is that instead of worrying so much about how thin your blood is, maybe you have to look at some of these other things I'm talking about. We're going to get in a second to hormone imbalances, but what's the nutrient balance and what's going on with homocysteine, because that's certainly a big one. What's going on with these folic acid metabolism problems? What's going on with fractionated, you know, particles of cholesterol? What's going on with your carbohydrate metabolism? What's causing your blood to run thick like this? Because the nutrient deficiencies will correct it. The drugs will only remove the symptom and put you at risk of bleeding out if you have an accident or having some kind of cerebral bleed or something. Vitamin K is withheld when people are given Coumadin. Now, Coumadin, it turns out, causes all kinds of other problems, including reducing all of the nutrients that you need to protect your heart, like folic acid and K and statins lower CoQ10 and carnitine. And so they destroy all of the vitamins that you need to protect yourself. So, it's arguable that if you're afraid of going off of Coumadin, that you can still take vitamin K if you just keep tabs on your dose of Coumadin and adjust it where necessary. But vitamin K is essential and is lowered by Coumadin, which I don't like as a drug. Now, we've just gone over a series of different things that are supposed to be causative. We've talked about cholesterol. We've talked about clotting and plaque. And now we're going to talk about, if I could find my place, hormone imbalances. So I think that I've given you some sense of what might actually be going on with issues around clotting and plaque. And we need to talk some about inflammation also. Actually, let me go to inflammation first. If you have a DNA mutation, that's going to cause some underlying inflammation because of nutrient deficiencies. Now, I'm not telling everybody to run out and get a $400 DNA mutation test, although they are available through alternative doctors, and you can even find some information on them in Jack Chalom's book, Feed Your Genes Right, and on his website, feedyourgenesright.com, he has a link to a DNA testing lab. This is not the kind of DNA testing lab that will, where your results will end up in the FBI files or something. This is a little more discreet, I think. I hope. But what they're really testing is cardiovascular parameters, and they're fairly interesting. But as I said, sometimes if you just look at your family line, you can anticipate some of this. And then you can also just have kind of testing done for your cardiovascular parameters without testing the DNA mutations by going to, there's a company online called Athrotech. And Athro is A-T-H-E-R. T-E-C-H. Oh, no, T...
A-T-H-E-R-O.
Do that again.
A-T-H-E-R-O.
Tech.
Tech. T-E-C-H.
.com. Good thing that you stayed down here. My political economist writer and dictionary. So Athrotech.com has a cardiovascular panel called the V as in Victor, A as in Albert, P as in Paul, VAP, VAP, Expanded Cholesterol Panel. If you get this panel done, and you do need a doctor to order it, although you can pay for it out of pocket if your insurance won't do it, and it's not that pricey. But if you have this, their recommendations will be conventional. So you may want to think about that. But the main thing is that you want to see what your parameters are, because if you want to find out if you have LPA, so you can take niacin, or you have high homocysteine tendency, or one of these other things, you know, we've discussed. The other things that cause inflammation are unresolved infections and chronic illness, and even dental infections, and Lyme disease, and, you know, anything where you've got unresolved chronic illness. Low thyroid function is huge for causing an inflammatory condition. Stress and deficiencies of all the vital health protective nutrients that I've been discussing, including folic acid, B12, B6, vitamin C, vitamin E. Remember vitamin E? Terribly important. Don't believe the research that says it's not. Vitamin D and vitamin K, along with you know, your whole multivitamin mix with all the little trace minerals in there that work in conjunction together with each other, all of that stuff. And then remember, the heart is a muscle. So coenzyme Q10, which is abbreviated COQ10, and carnitine are both important for protecting your energy cells in your muscles. And your heart is an enormous muscle, and it has to be protected. So any of this inflammation, high stress, unrelenting stress, unresolved infections, thyroid problems, and we're going to get into hormone imbalances also, and all of these mutations and all of these, but, you know, honestly, what we learned at the beginning of the show is just giving somebody vitamin C throughout the day made a difference in terms of whether they had a vasospasm that caused a heart attack. So it really can be treated with nutrients, but it really does need to be done. And when you look at the science of this, when you actually unpack all the little pathways and you see this goes to this, and if there isn't enough, you know, copper here, then this doesn't get produced, and then that doesn't happen with the zinc, and then this thing doesn't happen and the pathway doesn't work. And so a good multivitamin as a base, and then extra dosing of those things, if you see this kind of stuff in your family line, is the way to go. It's remarkably protective. I remember years ago I interviewed Dr. Oz, who calls himself a complementary or an alternative cardiologist. He is a cardiac surgeon, but he considers himself to be somehow alternative. But one of the things he said was that he had on his table one of two brothers who he was operating on, and the brother he was operating on had led a very discreet life and didn't have any bad habits, but he never took vitamins. And his brother drank alcohol and ate a little too much and was a little indiscreet, but he took vitamins, and he was not having heart problems. So you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm doing a show today on cardiovascular disease prevention. And we've been talking about inflammation and its causes. And one of those things was this issue of thyroid. So let's go to hormone imbalances, because they're quite important. So one of them is obviously low thyroid, right? The other one that's less obvious is estrogen dominance in both genders. And it might be predictable in a woman who has gone through menopause, or even young women, that they won't have enough progesterone on board. My observation, you know, because I do test women with saliva tests, is that in my client population, I see estrogen dominance in everybody. I mean, I don't see it in people who take extra progesterone, but I see it across the board at all ages. And I see it a lot in young women, too, which causes all kinds of health problems in young women. But estrogen dominance occurs in men as well. And men, as they age, or men as they pick up extra weight, will pick up extra estrogens. And the estrogen will contest testosterone in both genders. And testosterone is very heart protective. Progesterone, particularly in women, is very heart protective. And even estrogen itself, if it's too low, right? So if a woman is postmenopausal or has her uterus and ovaries removed, or just her uterus, her estrogen is likely to be low. It isn't inevitable. You should still test her. But this ratio of the various sex hormones working together, pushing against each other, is very important to protect the heart muscle as well. Obviously, overdosing people isn't going to be good. Estrogen particularly is very excitatory. So you have to have enough progesterone in women, and also testosterone and testosterone in men. Testosterone is also bone preserving and bone building. Now, testosterone was really studied a lot until the 80s very early in the 50s and 60s and stuff, by Jan Muller, who was Danish and very highly respected in his time. And no one could really argue with him because he was so brilliant. But it's very interesting that as soon as he died, his publication ceased to be available and the information is sort of buried. I was lucky enough to get, somebody was able to get me a copy of his book on cholesterol, which had to do with the effects of stress on testosterone and how stress raises cortisol, which lowers testosterone, and then people have heart events. And what he did was he treated both genders with heart problems with dosing of testosterone, and he reversed the effects. He corrected cardiovascular problems in people with testosterone. Very eminent researcher. Never hear about him. It's terrible. Somebody needs to republish his work. Now, adrenal hormones, people always talk about, oh, I have low adrenals, or my adrenals are worn out. Adrenals are going to try to protect you from too much cortisol by lowering the production of cortisol in chronic stress states. So if you're a real stressaholic and you work too hard and you exercise too much and you don't rest and you're very sympathetic dominant, you're very easily stimulated person and you don't relax easily and you don't sleep well, your cortisol may be too high, which is very cardiotoxic, or it'll be very low, which makes it very hard for you to utilize any of your other hormones, including thyroid, and including all the sex hormones. So under or overproduction of cortisol is going to be a problem for your heart. And it really comes down to stress being one of the major problems with heart problems. And this speaks to the editorial that we heard at the top of the show by Dr. Fawcett about the fact that you see a lot of these strokes and hypertension and heart problems and all of this in populations whose lives are extremely difficult. Now, increasingly, this is everybody, but certainly we see it among people who live in areas where their houses are built on toxic dumps, where all of the pathways are interrupted and disturbed by toxicity. We see it in conditions where people cannot make a living and feel hopeless and helpless, where their children are not able to get schooled or protected, where their stores are not selling real food, where everything is processed and they're being exposed to a lot of very highly processed foods with these very damaged fats. I mean, you want to know why to eat in a You don't eat in a fast food restaurant, because the fats alone will cause heart disease. Just the inflammation from eating damaged fats that have been overheated and processed will cause heart disease. There was a study done in Japan, 6 or 8 years ago, one of my favorite studies to cite, very large study, which was looking to see why heart disease had gone up in Japan, thinking that maybe it had to do with the fact that they were eating more meat. And in what they discovered, it was that the eating of more meat had actually lowered their stroke risk. The people were having less strokes. But that what had happened was that they were eating less fish, and they were using polyunsaturated oils, highly polyunsaturated, like corn and safflower oil and peanut oil and stuff, to fry in. So they were eating damaged omega-6 fats and not enough of the omega-3s, which used to be high in their diets, and skewing that balance between the 6s and the 3s, and eating these damaged processed fats was causing inflammation, and that was causing cardiovascular disease. So think of that. Stress is too much for people. Unrelenting stress. You have to recover from stress, no matter what kind of nutrients you take, although it helps to take the nutrients too. Too much insulin is cardiotoxic. Too much insulin, which is too much sugar, too much of your favorite comfort foods, all of the starches, the potatoes, the noodles, the cakes, the bread, the pasta, all of it creates high blood sugar, and then your body produces insulin to lower it, and insulin gets high. It's a hormone. It's important. Too much of it all the time, and it's toxic to your heart. Now remember, lack of exercise is also absolutely critical. You can take every vitamin in the vitamin store. You can meditate 16 times a day. If you don't move your body, your body is not going to make the kinds of adaptations and adjustments that it needs to make to keep all of your bones and joints and hearts and circulation healthy. You have to move. The heart is a muscle. It has to be exercised. It doesn't have to be exhaustive. You can walk. You can start by taking a 10-minute walk after every meal. It's pretty hard to talk yourself out of putting a rain jacket on and going out and walking for 10 minutes. 10 minutes isn't very long. If you can do that 2 or 3 times a day, you will see a marked improvement in your cardiovascular health. And if you can do more, if you can increase your vascular potential by even doing some weightlifting and some extra exercise or swimming or any of this walking or dancing in the house to music, you will add many years of health to your old age and years to your life. Now, remember all of the nutrients that I've mentioned that are heart protective: the folic acid, the B12, the B6, the vitamin C, the E, the D, the K, the CoQ10, the carnitine, and all the multivitamins and minerals are all reduced by statin drugs and blood thinners and by diuretics. Know what you're treating. Don't just start treating yourself with a drug. Know what you're treating. Test your cardiovascular parameters, your clotting factors. Do you have fractionated cholesterol? High triglycerides, are they over 100? Do you have lipoprotein A? Do you have homocysteine? Do you have the DNA mutation for folate problems like MTHFR? If you can't afford to test them, look at your family line and introduce a robust multivitamin with a good amount of B vitamins. Try to find some of the B12 that is the methyl MTHYL, methylcobalamin, not the cyanocobalamin. Take the extra B12, the B6, take the vitamin C throughout the day, any form of vitamin C. Vitamin E, 400 to 800 units a day. Vitamin D, if you don't get a lot of sun, 2 to 3,000 units a day, maybe even 4 if you really don't get out in the sun at all. Vitamin K, you're going to need about 10 milligrams of vitamin K a day, and it comes in micrograms. So you'll be looking for products that are in the milligram range and products that have extra K2, because all the research shows that it's not just K1, it's K2, and it's harder to find the K2. So you look for products that have K2 as well. I think that gives you some kind of overview. I hope that it releases you from the grip of being afraid of your cholesterol being too high. Ufi has told us many times that he himself comes from a line of people with high cholesterol, and there is not an increased risk of heart disease in his family. The parameters for cholesterol, everybody knew that they were around 250 for someone over 50. They were reduced to 200 so that people would comply with treatment, and that meant drugs. So don't be talked out of, don't be talked into lowering cholesterol, which is protective. Lower your other parameters like your triglycerides by adjusting your diet, getting rid of the high blood sugars, and taking the nutrients you need to keep your pathways working. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information, or if you want a CD, a copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows, information about guests, and the Progressive Health Observer Quarterly, go to the website yourownhealthandfitness.org, where you can listen to this show all week long. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness and KPFA-FM. The engineer for Your Own Health and Fitness is Simin Yohaki. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.